Now, this is probably the finest book to come out in recent years on Atlantis. Charles Berlitz had written an earlier one. He's of the language school fame. This is his most recent one, Atlantis, the Eighth Continent. There are over 5,000 books on Atlantis. Charles Berlitz, author of the Bermuda Triangle. It's good because it summarizes, and Berlitz is a good writer. We've been reading sections of it. The relevance to what we teach is who built the pyramid. Now, I was teaching on the pyramid when I left Dallas. I have news for you folks in Dallas. I stopped and haven't gone any further till I got you back. So you haven't missed much on the pyramid. Would you go along with that, folks, to your frustration? Now I'm starting to get back on the pyramid. That marvelous wonder that could not be built by any modern construction firm in the world. Perfectly aligned to true north. In fact, when they found it was a little bit off, they discovered it was because the earth shifted. Encased in its measurements, 4,000 plus years ago, many plus, I think, the circumference of the earth, the distance to the sun, the average height above sea level of the land masses of the earth, the exact point on the globe, it ought to be the meridian, not Greenwich, because it's exactly at the point on the globe where latitude and longitude crisscross and cover the largest portion of the landmass of the earth. It encased in its measurements the distance from the earth to the sun. It encased in its measurements the building unit of the universe. Now modern science can do it. You take the globe and you divide a hypothetical line from the North Pole to the South Pole into 500 million equal units. You will have what's called the pyramid inch. Some, and I'm one of those, call it the sacred inch, because it's used uniquely in the building of the Ark of the Covenant, in the building of Solomon's Temple, and Ezekiel, when he gives the design of the temple to be built during the millennium, he specifically says the long cubit. Make sure it's the long cubit, not the short cubit. Approximately the distance from elbow to index finger's tip, which varies with the length of the arm. The exact sacred cubit is 25 pyramid inches. And the pyramid inch, encased in three places as the measuring unit of the pyramid, is exactly 1/500 millionth of the diameter of the earth pole to pole. Two other places you find that inch: America and Britain. The British inch and the American inch that people try to change into the metric system. And the metric system was based upon measuring from pole to equator around the circumference of the globe and thus incorporated error. The perfect building block of the universe is that sacred inch, 1/500 millionth of the polar diameter of the earth. The British inch and the American inch, somebody brought it there. We take measurements for granted. Somebody started it. They've deviated a half a hair's breadth from the pyramid inch. Encased in the measurements of the pyramid, all 3 years, the solar year, the sidereal year, the anomalistic year, the point of revolutions as we go around the sun, the time it takes to return to perihelion, the exact distance where we're closest to the sun in the elliptical orbit, and that point where in going around the sun you return to a certain star in the heavens. Now the North Star now is Polaris. When the pyramid was built, it was Thuban, which means subtle, in the dragon constellation. All of the pyramids, I'm telling you, going out the gate, are copies. They were made burial places. The Great Pyramid of Giza was never intended to be a burial ground. How they built it, lifting 70-ton rocks and fitting them until it would take modern optical instruments to do the fitting in some cases, and cementing them with a cement that modern science has not yet developed that could cement horizontal vast expanses of the stones as they jointed together and still hold today. We have no way of building that pyramid. And, you know, people still come up with crazy ideas, like they find a hair somewhere and they say it was poured cement, as if you don't know the difference between limestone and granite and poured cement. Some people aren't just born stupid, they work to be stupid. This pyramid couldn't be built today. Whomever built it knew the heavens. And encased in it, Josephus said in the first century, that the descendants of Seth built two monuments, knowing the catastrophe was hitting the earth. They built two monuments, one of brick and one of stone, to encase the knowledge they wanted to preserve past the cataclysm. And in the first century, Josephus says, the one of brick is gone. The one of stone stands to this day in the land of Syria, speaking of the dog star worshipped by Egypt, a colloquial and common expression for the land of Egypt. The Egyptian Book of the Dead, long undeciphered, called that because there were scrolls buried with the dead people. When the Rosetta Stone was discovered, and when Champollion broke hieroglyphics, and it was discovered these are not paintings on the sides of caves, but an alphabet. And when they began to read the hieroglyphics, they could translate the Egyptian Book of the Dead, and they found that Egypt has always viewed that pyramid as a prophetic instrument that portrayed the descent of the human soul and the ascent, the way back to the resurrection chamber and to eternal life. They took the passages and broke them into units, explained them. It's always been viewed that way, and they call it the Pillar of Enoch. Now, in those passages of the pyramid, as we've taught on it in the past, and I have a book that I gave away, I don't want to give it away tonight. I don't want to have to tie the phones up, unless I get soft. But unless I say I'm going to do it, no, you can't have it. But in the pyramid are descending passages and ascending passages. There is a benchmark that lines up once through some 22,000 years that pinpoints a specific date in the pyramid when Orion, the Pleiades, and Alcyone, these constellations in the ball of the heavens roll by. And every 2,000 years, a different constellation and a different star moves into the position of being true north. And true north has nothing to do with magnetic north. You take a rum line and take the pole of the earth from south to north and just shove it right on out there in space, and it'll hit on the ball of the heavens a certain star, and that's true north. Polaris is there now. Thuban, as I've said, meaning subtle. In the dragon constellation, the symbol of the devil, was the North Star in those days. And the descending passage was so perfectly aligned that on a given day and a given year, you stand at the bottom of the passage and the light of that star would shine all the way down that passage. And a certain benchmark crosshair, scored lines built on the descending passage, line up with Alcyone and the Pleiades, and a dating system is set up 1 year for an inch that perfectly marks the exodus of Egypt, or the Israelites out of Egypt, perfectly marks the birth of Christ, perfectly marks the resurrection of Christ, perfectly marks the entrance into the First World War, perfectly marks the length of the First World War, and right on into the King's Chamber. Now, people have made mistakes, as they have with biblical prophecy. They've set dates. And Davidson, the giant who went to prove there was no prophetic meaning in the pyramid, wrote the most convincing proof that there was a prophetic meaning, but he was so overwhelmed, he set 1936 as you come out of the passage into the King's Chamber as the end of the world, and because it didn't happen, his overkill in that regard turned people off. The next greatest scholar was Rutherford, who set 1979 as the end of the world because suddenly limestone floor changed to granite, and he decided God wouldn't have a prophetic pattern on granite. Totally arbitrary. And again, all of his research in four volumes falls into a certain disrepute because he set a date. Well, people have been doing that since the Brother of the Lord and Augustine, with the Bible setting dates and being wrong. But nobody abandons the Bible because some have misused it. Pyramid is God's prophetic message in stone. It doesn't change the Bible. It is a confirmation, as God wrote his message in the stars also. And there's a new interest in this marvelous monument, and people are beginning to understand that Isaiah 19:19, a prophecy of the last days, says that at the center of Egypt and at the border thereof, and Egypt's the only land in the world you could say that about because there's Upper and Lower Egypt, and the ancient pharaohs wore different colored hats, whether they ruled Upper Egypt, Lower Egypt, or both of them. And right on the Giza Plateau, which means edge, stands this pyramid. And the Bible says in Isaiah 19:19 that in the last days there will be a witness, an altar, and altars can be monuments of witness as well as places to offer sacrifice, an altar to the Lord in the last days as a witness. There can only be one thing there. And the question we've asked, is this wonder of the ages, the last of the great seven wonders of the world that exist, is it God's prophetic plan in stone that will enable him in the last days right there in the center and at the border of Egypt to say, I told you so? If you argue with the Bible about its translations, inches are inches. The pyramid has got its measuring units built in. Now, who built it is the question we've been asking. The Christ triangle in the pyramid, you lay it on the north face of the pyramid and follow that triangle, degrees, rung line, it hits Bethlehem. You go to the great stone circle, Stonehenge in Britain, and you draw the marker stones and just crisscross from the northwest corner marker stone of the Stonehenge circles and the outer ditch embankment with the post holes there, and the marker stones, there are four of them, you draw from the northwest to the southeast one and keep the rum line going and swim right across the Mediterranean, it hits the pyramid right on the nose. Now, who built these monuments? Did Enoch? Now, some say it was built during Cheops' reign. This is one thing I've started to do, I didn't do, while in Dallas. And that was to prove, and I haven't yet done it yet, I just said I will prove it. One of the great arguments that it was built during Cheops' reign is that Herodotus, the Greek historian, said it was built during Cheops' reign. Well, how do you know? He took the word of a priest in Egypt whose business it was to support what the Pharaoh said. Now, the other support is the kernel of ice found in the chambers above the King's Chamber, hieroglyphics. I'll prove to you there were forgeries. There are no markings in the pyramid except that little hieroglyphic with the cartouche of Cheops in the upper chambers the kernel of ice found. He did it as a fraud, and his forger ended up owning one of the better hotels of the day near the pyramid. I've dared to say that I believe Enoch built it, and that he had some help with those watchers, as the apocryphal book tells us. And I have dared to say that I am with Isaac Vail, the Pasadena scholar, that the earth that was before the flood had a canopy. opened to the north and to the south of the poles, but there was a canopy, and the firmament was between. There was water above as well as water on the earth. And that before the flood, in the ages that were past, I believe Atlantis existed. And poor old Edgar Casey, like him or lump him, who talked in his sleep, and people wrote it down, and it was called readings, said in 68 or 69, Atlantis would rise. Not that the kingdom of Atlantis would rise, but there would be around Bimini and in the Caribbean, you would find remnants of Atlantis. It was in 68 that Dr. Valentine began his explorations and discovered these giant stones with cornerstones, what apparently was the upper portion of a causeway they should begin to dig underneath. And these other strange happenings in the Bermuda Triangle. Now, if Atlantis sunk, Otto Muck's theory is kind of interesting. Otto Muck has the sinking of Atlantis occur with a breakup of plugs in these shifting continents that drift on each side of the central Atlantic plateau that was above, take a picture if you will, above the water at that time, and the plugs blew out, and this Atlantic plateau in Otto Muck's theory sank below the surface, leaving the Azores, the Canaries, and other islands above the sea, and sunk, and the plugs filled in again. His theory is that Atlantis was right here to explain why the eels still swim from the Seaweed Sea off the coast of Brazil and south of Florida, all the way to Europe, and then underneath the Gulf Stream back again for the marriage as they mate 2 years later. Those on the west side swim a little ways to fresh waters in the Americas. Were these eels seeking the fresh waters of Atlantis? Not there anymore. Why do birds, as some have seen, fly out to sea with an instinct, searching a land that isn't there, drop to their death? I am a believer. I won't tantalize you. I'm a believer in Atlantis and that a great civilization existed there. Now, in and around the Bermuda Triangle, strange things have been surfacing for years. But the remnants of a possible human structure have been surfacing in recent years, since 1968. Now, if you'll let me bore you again, I will read these little things for Dallas, okay? Can I bore you? Here is the Greek industrialist, Harry Marshall, on an expedition in 1978. He remembers some of the details, seeking television footage of a pyramidal mound off of Kaysaw Bank at a depth of over 750 feet in the Bermuda Triangle. The first thing we noticed when we got near the area was that all the compasses were going berserk. We spent 8 hours making tapes. Starting at 700 feet to 1,500 feet deep, we would go about a mile, then make a 90-degree turn and go back again. Finally, I saw it coming up on the sonar screen. I'm reading Atlantis, the Eighth Continent by Charles Berlitz. I told the captain to stop and then to proceed slowly. If you don't have this in your own bookstore, we got it. $16.95, about $18 in cover mailing. Finally, I saw it coming up on the sonar screen. I told the captain to stop and then to proceed slowly. We were right over the pyramid. The top seemed to be about 150 feet from the surface, with the total depth about 650 feet. We lowered the camera. And high-intensity lights down the side of the mass, and suddenly came to an opening. Light flashes or shining white objects were being swept into the opening by turbulence. They may have been gas or some sort of energy crystals. Further down, the same thing happened in reverse. They were coming out again at a lower level. It was surprising that the water in this deep area was green instead of black, near the pyramid, even at night. Now, Dr. Brown. Swimming. It was in this very area, southwest of the Kaisal Bank, that in 1977, a huge pyramid was reported as having appeared in outline on the depth finder of a boat during a deep sea fishing trip. That's what Harry Marshall was seeking. Dr. Brown went swimming. Ray Brown, diver and lecturer of Mesa, Arizona. You've heard this before, but I'd like to fit it together again. As we swam on, he says, the water became clearer. I was close to the bottom at 135 feet and was trying to keep up with the diver ahead of me. I turned to look toward the sun through the murky water and saw a pyramid shape shining like a mirror. About 35 to 40 feet from the top was an opening. Now, the point I'm making is somebody knew how to build these things. And ain't nobody found out yet. Now, isn't it interesting that in one of the reputed areas of Atlantis, now they've located, some theorists put Atlantis in Heligoland, some put it in the Antarctic. There's been a big argument to put it in the Mediterranean, the Isle of Terra. Some put it in the Sahara Desert. Why do you think they call the Atlantic Ocean Atlanta? Atlantic. Why are the Atlas Mountains on the coast of Africa? There's a heavy concentration of scholars who want to put it in South America on the east coast. Well, I'm sure that Atlantis touched all of these if it existed. And I'm contending that from Atlantis came the skills to build a pyramid. I'm contending that it was on Atlantis that the Garden of Eden was. And it was on Atlantis that the Tree of Life was. And it was from Atlantis. Let's go on. Interesting that in this area, if Atlantis is here, you find pyramids. I turned to look toward the sun through the murky water and saw a pyramid shape shining like a mirror. About 35 to 40 feet from the top was an opening. Dr. Brown says, I was reluctant to go inside. But I swam in anyway. The opening was like a shaft debouching into an inner room. I saw something shining. It was a crystal held by two metallic hands. I had on my gloves and I tried to loosen it. The man had guts. It became loose. As soon as I grabbed it, I felt this was the time to get out and not come back. Smart man. He still has that crystal. The author of this book speaks of examining it. The author of this book says he doesn't know whether it's psychosomatic or real, but you feel in your hand when you hold it a throbbing sensation in the hand of the holder. Now, the candidate for the mayor's office in Orlando, Florida. Can I read this again? I'll get to some new stuff for you folks tonight. I was about 45 miles northeast of Miami and flying at about 250 feet above sea level when a hissing... Hey, I'm not going to cram Atlantis down anybody's throat. I don't care whether anybody believes anything that I believe. I just feel you ought to be forewarned. I hate an objective historian. I want to know where the boy stands. Then I know how to watch for his opinion, his facts, and see if he knows the difference. Now, I've come to believe Atlantis existed. The Bible says the earth that then was there wasn't any rain. And until somebody comes up with a better theory, Isaac Bale's canopy theory is the best explanation I can come up with. Firmament means expanse. And I know there was water up there as well as on the earth. And that when the flood came, if you believe the Bible, that overhead container of water, whatever it was, burst. And the fountains of the deep gushed up. People lived a long time, were awful smart. And one wonders, they began to die. Lifespan shortened immediately after the flood. Was that because the canopy was gone? Sun's rays have an aging effect upon you. They were protected before the flood. Now, as smart as we are, you know how smart we'd be if we lived 900 years? Do you realize what a criminal thing it is to waste youth on youth? Man, if I could take my head and put it in a young body. You ever felt that way? I know I've gotten 10 times smarter the last year than I did the previous year. It compounds. You know, the gestalt takes over. You begin to interweave the various things you know. I mean, I just get so thrilled when I think about how smart I'd be if I could live 900 years. Smart people like you. This genius church we're building. My Lord, would be smart. These people live 900 years. And as I said last week, I read the good old Art Tanakh series, probably the best Jewish commentary in recent years, on those passages in Genesis where it says the sons of God came down, saw the daughters of women were beautiful, and fiddly-dee, and produced monsters, giants. Now then, good Jewish scholarship, they said there are three choices. Descendants of Seth married the descendants of Cain. One, that's foolish. Both Seth and Cain carried the genes with Adam and Eve in them. Plus, Noah married Canaan's daughter. Second, it means the rulers married the peons, horse feathers. Then, rather hesitantly, they said, or it means what it says. Some supernatural, more than natural as we know it, came down and got involved with the women of the earth. What the Bible says, produced giants. Now, if you read the apocryphal literature, Book of Jubilees, Book of Enoch, Book of Jasher, you'll find in some of them references to what are called watchers, and that Enoch dwelt with the watchers. Now, if Enoch was sent from Atlantis to build this monument in stone that God might preserve a record for this day, and if he had these watchers to help him as his construction crew, how many trouble then figuring out how these superhuman beings built that pyramid, moved those rocks around. But like all construction crews, on their weekends off, they got involved with the women of this earth. Every ancient hieroglyphic has the symbol of the mountain as the place you find God. Every ancient religion has it. As time goes on, it's incorporated in the myths of every nation. You have Mount Olympus in Greece as a type. But all ancient cultures go to a mountain to find God. Was Atlantis constructed in such a way that the highest point on Atlantis somehow went through the firmament and through that canopy? Or did they come from the north? There's an ancient tradition that heaven is north. Not magnetic north necessarily, but if the canopy broke and at the northern rim of the canopy, you would see out to the blue sky and the stars. Access from heaven would be through that funnel, or through a mountain that pierced the canopy. Those watchers got here, those sons of God got here from somewhere. Now, the Dogon people in Central Africa worship a star you can't see, as you well know, Sirius B, which they say is the place of heaven. There's some mysteries here that can't be explained. Now, I'm sure the church will be dealing with what I'm dealing with next. Every time I get on it, they get on it. I want them to be sure to do it right, not butchered up like they did the Dogon people. But if Atlantis existed, when it was buried, maybe some strange things were buried with it. Now, nobody can explain the Bermuda Triangle. Is there some source down there of power? I was about 45 miles northeast of Miami, this fellow said, flying at about 250 feet above sea level, when a hissing, smashing updraft hit me. It bounced the plane about 1,000 feet upward. Now, I've been in updrafts and downdrafts, but nothing like this. After I got back to more or less normal, I noticed that the water had become bright and silvery. I noticed something big under the water. Thought it was a wrecked ship. It was not far from the surface. Something was causing the water to rush past it at a fast rate. It curled around it, made a deep channel. We're in the Bermuda Triangle now. The ocean seemed to be opening up, and I was now flying low in a sort of trough in the water with both sides of it along the wingtips. I suddenly realized that what I was looking at was not a ship at all, but seemed to be a huge building down in the water. The water seemed to get shallower around it. I could see a slanting side of a building that looked like a mountain. I was down at about 50 feet from the surface and could see it in the water. I circled around it for about a minute and a half. I could even see barnacles on it and water running past the top of it. Enough to scare poor Pilot Spitless. At my point of angle and from my position, I could clearly see it was a monstrous building. The sun was radiating in such a way that in its rays I could see this huge building clearly visible down under the water. I thought I saw other buildings around it, but I couldn't see them well. The one I was looking at must have been 100 to 250 feet high, according to the pattern I could get. I started to time myself on the leg out to get readings of the location when out of this blue, clear day, another strange incident occurred. All my magnetics had gone to zero. Then a strange hue occurred all around me. Now, Columbus saw a strange glow as he approached these islands, something some historians fail to tell you. At about 600 feet above water in the air, that bright crimson hue simply baffled me. That 240-horsepower Continental began to be the most crazily running engine I have ever had the experience to feel. It became motionless. No matter what I did with the throttle and pumps, it glided and floated smoothly for at least 2 miles. Then the engine simply started itself. I couldn't dive because I was already on top of the water. Then I realized that some force was pulling toward a westerly direction. Now, after all this, I finally got back to the airport with my Bendix blasting hell out of everybody, but not a single band would respond. After landing and getting inspection of radio communication and units, every last unit was blown, shorted out with some high-frequency electronic shock or mysterious high voltage in the air. They said I might have run through a magnetic belt or something. Now, over the past years, this is the candidate for mayor in Orlando, Florida. Over the past years, he says, I've been back many times, but I could never sight it again. He says, a lot of damned Miamians made fun of my story. It's awful to be alone when you see something like that. But I know I'm right. And he's talking to Dr. Valentine, who has, after 16 years exploration, come across these structures beneath the sea near Bimini and in the Bermuda Triangle area. And he's talking to him. He says, a lot of damn Miamians made fun of my story, but I know I'm right. You've hit with the sonar instruments the very object I talked about in exactly the same area. Now, am I boring you? We've got to get back to some of these, don't we? October 21st, 1962, was the 50th wedding anniversary of Anthony and Emma Hessler of Fort Lauderdale. To celebrate, they took a three-day cruise to Nassau aboard the SS Florida. The big white cruise ship sailed from Miami at about 5:15 p.m. on Friday, October 19th. Holding hands, the Hesslers stood at the rail on the promenade deck, looking back at the vessel's wake and the Miami skyline. Now I'm reading The Devil's Triangle 2 by Richard Weiner. He wrote The Devil's Triangle. This is number 2, second book. Strange. Have you caught on? Now, Dallas wouldn't, because I'm just with them, though they catch on fast. Have you caught on what I'm trying to do? That there are strange things that go on in the Bermuda Triangle that nobody has explained. Now, my purpose in teaching is there is no ability to understand the great mysteries of this earth without a knowledge of the Bible taught right. You know, this idea that you park your brains at the door of a church when you walk in, and the spirituality is synonymous with ignorance, that's what I'm against. I'm on a crusade to prove there aren't going to be any dummies in heaven. That's why I like Dallas. It's full of smart people. Like Fort Worth, smart people. The sky was cloudless. The sea was flat, calm. The only wind was that created with the ship's movement. At approximately 7 o'clock, the Hesslers, bless their sweethearts, sat down at their table in the dining room for their evening meal. They had just been served their soup and salad when suddenly Emma Hessler found herself sitting on the deck, covered with her food. Trays of food were flying across the room. Chairs, tables, food, and people were sliding across the dining room. The ship had suddenly listed 45 degrees to the port. Then, slowly, very slowly, that's where we were when I left it the last time, isn't it? Okay? Now let's find another. I just want you to see strange things. Let's leave that one right there. If I didn't dangle something, you'd be mad. Although the United States Coast Guard can usually offer some sort of logical explanation for many of the strange happenings in the Devil's Triangle, their own vessels are not immune to them. The USCGC, that's United States Coast Guard cutter Yamacraw, was a former World War II mine layer converted to the Coast Guard. Am I boring you now? Because you've heard this. But don't you think we ought to make other people suffer like you did?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. You've got to get a little tension into this. Strange things go on. My advice is don't take a honeymoon or an anniversary in the Bermuda Triangle. Do what you want, but Yamacraw was a former World War II mine layer converted by the Coast Guard to a combination cable laying and research ship. On August 8, 1956, the Yamacraw was on a heading of 165 degrees. Now, the 189-foot ship was under the command of William D. Strouch. Her normal complement was 51. Now, this is the boat that had a white hull. No, a white superstructure and a black hull. August 8, 1956, the Yamacraw was on a heading of 165 degrees. Her position was 30 degrees 65 north and 73.80 west, which placed her in what is sometimes referred to as the Sargasso Sea, which is Seaweed Sea, being translated, an area north and east of the Bahamas, approximately 500 miles east of Jacksonville. It was 0130 hours when the radio operator, or rather the radar operator, called out, "Large landmass dead ahead, range 28 miles. "Impossible," responded Ensign Francis J. Flynn. I'd call myself Frank. "There's only one landmass on our heading, and that's the Dominican Republic over 800 miles away." The radar operator adjusted and readjusted his equipment. Again, he called the officer of the watch. "Ensign Flynn, the radar is showing a landmass directly ahead on our course. Take a look for yourself." That's what he said. Flynn studied the radar screen. "You're right. It's got to be a landmass. Look how straight it is, almost as if it were drawn by a pencil. Wake up the skipper. I'm going to check the compasses and take another position fix." The sea was flat, smooth. The sky was clear. Every star and constellation that should have been visible in that area was in view. The compasses were correct. The ensign sightings tallied with his precision fix. Still, the radar screen showed a huge landmass directly ahead on the Amcross course. Steaming at 12 and a half knots, the ship had reduced the distance to 24 miles. "Maintain 165 degrees, ordered the captain. Less than 2 hours later, those on the bridge were gazing ahead in awe. No more than a mile ahead, looming up out of the sea, was a huge dark mass that seemed to stretch from horizon to horizon and reach skyward as high as the men could see. The radar..." This is a good ship, Yamacraw, U.S. Coast Guard. "The radar, which was capable of penetrating fog, showed this to be a solid mass. Minutes later, the Yamacraw was alongside the huge mass. Commander Strauch ordered his men to rig the 36-inch diameter carbon arc searchlight. As the ship moves along slowly, parallel to the mass, the men noticed that it did not come up out of the water, but rather started about a foot and a half to 2 feet above the sea's surface." The ship was less than 50 feet away when the big searchlight was turned on. Yet its powerful beam penetrated no more than a few feet into it. The radar could not penetrate the mass at all. The light disclosed the color as being a brownish gray. For half an hour, the Yamacraw steamed slowly along the edge of the mass. From time to time, the captain would order the ship to penetrate it for a minute or so at a time. There was no dampness or temperature change, as there would have been in the case of fog. No one was on the starboard side of the Yamacraw as it eased into the mass. Then the ship pulled several hundred yards away and continued steaming alongside the mass, which formed a straight line running northeast to southwest. After a few minutes, Commander Strauch ordered the helm eased over to the starboard, and the USCGC Yamacraw slowly eased back into the strange brownish gray mass that was impenetrable by either searchlight or radar. The high-intensity carbon arc lamp became only a dull glow, and then only when one looked directly at it. And as before, there was no change in temperature or humidity. On deck, visibility was absolute zero. Some of the men groping their way around the Yamacraw's deck commented that the substance into which they had steamed felt like suspended particles of fine sand or dust, yet there was no movement of the mass, as there would have been had it been one of those rare dust storms at sea. The air was dead still. The ship moved forward with just enough way to maintain steerage. The radar screen showed only a green clutter. The ship's compasses still worked. Suddenly, there was a spontaneous... That's where we left it. I will leave that there. We got a mast now and a tilden table. And a pyramid raising up out of the water with a poor guy from Orlando that says the Miamians don't believe it. And we got Dr. Brown swimming in there and getting a crystal out of one that he still has. And we got Harry Marshall photographing it beneath the sea. And Dr. Valentine finding these causeway passages. And a yarmulke and a mass. Well, let's see what else we got. Oh, I remember. It was daylight. The sun had not yet... Am I boring you?
No.
The sun had not yet lifted above the horizon. The weather was clear and balmy as the motor vessel Atlantic City plied westward less than a day away from her destination. You want me to buy these books and give them to you? Not sure I can find them. I'll try. The weather was clear and balmy as the motor vessel Atlantic City plied westward less than a day away from her destination. W.J. Morris of Lanfrisson, South Wales, was on lookout duty atop the Atlantic City's bridge. Soon it'd be time to waken the rest of the crew and ready the ship for entering port. Morris was joined to the officer of the watch, who chatted for a few minutes before returning below to the wheelhouse. We're in the Bermuda Triangle. You got that? Suddenly, the officer gave out a yell. The ship was running wild, zigzagging and circling erratically. Then the two men saw what Morris later described as a great ball of fire, traveling rapidly and heading directly for the ship. It was on a collision course with the Atlantic City. Panicking, Morris began to jump over the wind dodger to the foredeck below. The mate grabbed him, pulled him back to the deck, and the two terrified men lay there, covering their faces. Mate said, leave me here alone. Hearing no noise whatsoever, they looked up. The fireball was nearly upon them. Its glare made them squint, making no roar or noise whatsoever. It passed directly over the ship, clearing the masthead by what seemed like only inches. The men leaped to their feet. But the phenomenal ball of fire now I go here. Am I boring you? December 5th, 1945, was a typical South Florida winter day. On that day, Flight 19, under the command of Lieutenant Charles C. Taylor of Corpus Christi, Texas, a 6-year Navy veteran, was to take out the lead plane, the squadron, of torpedo bombers on a routine flight into the Bermuda Triangle. This is probably the most famous mystery about the Bermuda Triangle, how these five planes and the Mariner search plane and 27 men could disappear without a trace. I was reading, last time we were on this, this record, which includes the radio transmission with Flight 19 up to the point of its disappearance. I'd like to read it again and go past that message. Wouldn't you?
Yes,
but it's almost midnight. What's your position? The tower radioed. We're not sure of our position, radioed Lieutenant Taylor. We can't be sure just where we are. We seem to be lost. The tower operators were startled. How could five planes with experienced crews be lost with fair to good flight conditions? Now, this is only the beginning of the loss of strange planes and strange happenings in the Bermuda Triangle. Now, scientists believe things have always gone on as they are. They hated Velikovsky. And those who argue that cataclysms occurred. Well, you can't believe the Bible not believe in cataclysms. The flood was one. Jeremiah saw the earth before there was any man on it. Ezekiel and Isaiah let us know that Lucifer was on the earth and in Eden before he fell. There's a vast gulf of time between Genesis 1:1 and Genesis 1:2. Literally, Genesis 1:1 reads, "In the beginning God created the heavens and the earth." Probably the best translation is, "The beginning of the creations." The beginning of God's creations of the heavens and the earth. It's a record that starts with God. Second verse reads, in the King James, "The earth was without form and void." Just as literally it can be translated, "The earth became a waste and a desolation." Jeremiah, in a vision that's past, sees an earth that was good. There was no man on it. Yet he says there are cities. The Greek word aliar means meeting places of intelligent beings. There was no man, but there were cities of this type. He then sees a great cataclysm strike the earth. Mountains moved, and he uses the exact same words in the Hebrew of Genesis 1:2, "The earth became a waste and a desolation." We have forced kids to believe Bishop Usher's genealogical tables that the earth was created 4004 B.C., September, I think. I think old Bishop Lightfoot figured out a certain hour of the morning. This earth's been around a long, long time. The precession of the equinoxes takes 22,000 years. You are not required, in order to be a Christian, to put your head in a sack and close your eyes to what science has revealed. But science is a matter of faith. And most scientists have a faith premise that can't be proven, and indeed, evidence suggests the wrong. And that faith premise is, all things have always been as they are and worked at the same rate in the same way. The cataclysmic theorists say there have been shocking changes. I firmly believe at some age of the earth, the poles changed. Once that fellow shocked them at the meeting in Switzerland, when he was supposed to give a study on something else, and the father of glacial geology burst forth on the scene with his evidence for a glacial age. Finally, the church began to accept that these markings on the rocks were not as a result of Noah's flood and accepted glaciation. Now the mystery is that in Africa you'll find glaciers moving from the equator. Not from the North Pole toward the equator. You find markings that indicate the ice pack was at the equator moving the other direction. These poles tilted at some time or other with cataclysmic results. Now, something strange is going on in this Bermuda Triangle. I get so frustrated at some people's teachings on demonology. If you can find the devil stalking backwards in a rock record, he's too stupid to worry about. I mean, if that's the way he occupies his intelligence, don't worry about him. And I was across Australia when they were spitting demons out on napkins. Man, if you can encompass the devil in a gob of spit, don't worry about him. Demons exist. Jesus saw Satan cast down, and a third of heaven went with him. He confronted them and they begged him not to send them to the abyss, the bottomless pit it's called. What is the bottomless pit? It's the abyss. There's only one word in the Greek, abyss. The demons. Some of them were assigned to the deeps. Now, if I'm going to talk on demonology, I'm going to talk about the big boys. The ones that kept an angel from coming to talk to Daniel for 3 weeks. And he had to get Michael to help him fight them. Now, the book of Revelation says the key to the bottomless pit will be used to lock Satan in it, but it also says earlier that out of that same bottomless pit, these locust demons come who bring pain to man on earth, except those that have the mark 144,000. That's not the church, by the way. Neither Jehovah's Witness found them. Out of that abyss come these locust demons. Are some of them chained? What is the source of that strange happening in the Bermuda Triangle? Now, I'd like to follow the flight of Flight 19 with you. And I'd like to get back on Atlantis this week and have it lead me to Holy Blood, Holy Grail. So I have your permission to not raise money for a few days if you'll just bring the budget in without me having to do it. I wonder if I put Dallas-Fort Worth to sleep. Are you interested in these little stories? I got another book here tonight, a whole bunch more. Do you know some airliners have disappeared also? You know the story of the first jet to disappear? Well, we'll stick with Flight 19, but only if you call me. So we're leaving some stations. We're not leaving Dallas-Fort Worth. I want you to know that. Will you get on the telephone and talk to me? The number's 1-800-338-3030. Play a 1-0. That's the song that tells you to go to the telephone. I'll go home unless I know you're there. Pretty late here on the West Coast, too. All you folks in San Diego and Los Angeles that joined us, get on the telephone and talk to me right now. And if you're still there in Dallas-Fort Worth and you're interested in the subject of Atlantis, talk to me. I'll stay on it a while.